going to create some ripples across the nation, really, on pricing. It does show some pretty big disparities between hospitals.
Medicare releases information on hospital charges for the first time. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Arctic scientists discuss emerging climate change problems.
And this past fall, winter, and spring have just dished up an unbelievable array of very unusual weather patterns.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has accounting degrees online to prepare students with the skills required by Alaska's industries. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
How much does a hospital charge for a certain procedure? That information can be difficult for consumers to access before they get a bill in the mail. Now, for the first time, the federal government is publicly sharing what hospitals charge Medicare for the 100 most common procedures. And the information shows hospitals across the country and across Alaska charge dramatically different prices for the same procedure. At least one hospital in the state is considering adjusting their prices after reviewing the data. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Rick Davis has spent more than a decade working in Alaska hospitals, and the CEO of Central Peninsula General Hospital in Soldotna was eager to review the massive Excel spreadsheet on hospital prices as soon as it was out.
It's going to create some ripples across the nation, really, on pricing. It does show some pretty big disparities between hospitals.
For example, Alaska Regional in Anchorage charges Medicare more than $46,000 for a patient with heart failure and a major complication. Alaska Native Medical Center, also in Anchorage, charges less than half that amount. In both cases, Medicare doesn't pay anywhere close to the full charge. They reimburse Regional $14,000 and Alaska Native $13,000. Private insurance usually pays more than Medicare, but negotiates the amount. It's a system that doesn't make much sense, but Davis says more transparency will help.
For there to be pressure on pricing from the consumer side, the consumer has to understand, you know, what it's going to cost them. And so, you know, I think this is a good report. I think it's going to force hospitals to address their pricing.
Davis says the data show the prices at his own hospital, Central Peninsula, are fair, and he doesn't expect to make any adjustments. But Bruce Lamoureux, CEO of Providence in Anchorage, says his hospital will consider changing some prices, down or even up, based on the report.
There are some instances where our charges for a particular procedure are either, in one case, half of a different provider's, and in a different case, twice a different provider.
Lamoureux thinks the information actually gives consumers some negotiating power when it comes to healthcare costs, something they've never had before. He says the system of hospital pricing and reimbursement is badly broken, and this step towards more transparency is long overdue. But a hospital bill is only one part of the overall healthcare cost picture. Karen Perdue is president of the Alaska Hospital Association. She says the hospital charge is just a starting point.
That's kind of like a rack rate in a hotel room. I mean, most people are not paying that one rate in the hotel. So different payers are demanding different deals at the hospital. And so I think what consumers need is not only a more accurate way to determine what their costs are going to be, but also what the full cost will be, not just the hospital cost.
Like the charges from doctors and anesthesiologists, which aren't included in a hospital bill. Perdue says the Alaska Hospital Association board is looking at ways to make hospital cost data easily available to consumers. But healthcare is a complicated industry, and it's not an easy task.
You know, transparency for us feels like the future and where we should be going and where we should be putting our effort. How we actually do that in a way that's meaningful to the consumer is the challenge ahead of us.
Several hospital executives in Alaska hope the new information from Medicare encourages others in the industry, like doctors, to also make their prices more publicly available to consumers. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
To see a graph of what hospitals around the state charge for two common procedures, go to alaskapublic.org. We also have a link to the full Medicare spreadsheet on hospital charges there. Environmental changes from climate warming are hitting the Arctic harder and faster than anyone predicted. This week, top Arctic scientists have been meeting in Anchorage, looking for better ways to investigate and even track the changes and what they could mean. APRN's Steve Heimel was there.
They call them emerging research questions, and the Polar Research Board of the National Academy of Sciences has put together a committee to identify them and recommend how to tackle them. The committee called on all kinds of other scientists for help: hydrologists, mappers, oceanographers, biologists, weather analysts, sociologists, anthropologists, geologists, and more. Committee co-chair, Alaska anthropologist Henry Huntington, says the emerging issues are ones that scientists did not anticipate.
Many of the important questions are things we've been asking for quite some time and are continuing to answer and to refine our answers for. The emerging questions are, what are the things that are new that we haven't really been thinking about or anticipating?
A really big one is weather. And if a connection can be drawn between changing conditions in the Arctic and extreme weather elsewhere. That has become a specialty for committee member Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University.
And this past fall, winter, and spring have just dished up an unbelievable array of very unusual weather patterns. So the more that happens, the harder it is to say that there isn't some connection to the Arctic and to climate change in general.
And Francis knows what she's talking about. For the past year and a half, she has been poring through past weather records and comparing them to computer climate models. And she's found that a warming Arctic tends to loosen the jet stream. It wanders more to the south and north, and the weather systems fall into patterns.
We're looking at how the waves in the atmosphere and how those have changed in their shape, in their speed of motion, where they tend to be setting up. You know, there are some places where we tend to get these big northward swings in the jet stream, which cause these what we call blocking patterns. And we're seeing that they're definitely changing over time, and they are seeming to appear in certain places rather than other places.
The big rushes of warm tropical air that Alaska got a couple of times this past midwinter are examples of that. Is this the new normal for air circulation? That's the emerging research question. There are plenty of other ones: the consequences of more fresh water coming into the Arctic, and whether the waters will begin to mix more, and what that might do to the deep currents of the North Atlantic. And then there's the evidence that huge amounts of methane stored in undersea permafrost are entering the atmosphere off the coast of Russia. Dozens of scientists, dozens more research questions. Nobody knows much yet about how plankton are changing because of thinner ice letting more sunlight in instead of reflecting it. So far, it looks like it's leading to more plankton, which feeds the whole food chain, or maybe falls into the sediments because there's nobody to eat it. And then there's the ice itself. In the past, part of the summer pack ice has been thicker, formed sometimes centuries ago. But now, most of the ice in the Arctic Ocean is thinner, formed within the year. And it acts differently, says sea ice specialist Julianne Strovey of the National Snow and Ice Data Center.
The whole marginal ice zone is expanding, and the biological and ecological impacts of that increase in the first-year ice is really not something that's well understood yet.
One thing they learned this winter was that first-year ice can break up more easily under extreme wind conditions, because that's what it did in the Beaufort Sea in February. The committee will meet later in Canada and hopes to turn in its recommendations for new research directions and the infrastructure that would require at about this time next year. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, former King Island residents and their descendants are planning a trip back to their village.
Just walk around, listen to the birds, smell the air one more time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Juneau officials are keeping an eye on legislation making its way through Congress that would allow states to collect sales tax on online purchases. The U.S. Senate this week voted 69 to 27 in favor of the Marketplace Fairness Act. While Alaska does not have a statewide sales tax, the city and borough of Juneau is one of many municipalities with a local tax on the sale of goods and services. CBJ Finance Director Bob Bartholomew says he's still studying the Senate bill, but he thinks there might be a way for municipalities to collect local taxes if the Alaska legislature passes enabling legislation.
I think we could do it without the state having a sales tax, but they may have to be involved as far as state legislation helping us standardize things.
Bartholomew says it's too soon to speculate what that state legislation might look like. But the types of things that would need to be standardized include the tax rate and exemptions. He also says it's too soon to say what, if any, effect the federal or state legislation would have on the amount of sales tax collected by the city.
The next step for us, especially if it starts making progress in the House, is to get in touch with the state of Alaska and with the Alaska Municipal League to see if what the next steps are for trying to, you know, share the information and get the coordination across the state that we'll need for implementation.
Bartholomew says the CBJ's lobbyists in Washington will keep track of the Marketplace Fairness Act's progress in the House. The city and borough of Juneau has a 5% sales tax that includes three components: a permanent 1% tax, a temporary 3% tax that largely funds essential city services, and a temporary 1% tax dedicated to capital projects. An Anchorage-based community development quota group wants a greater share of Alaska's deep-sea fisheries. The Coastal Villages Region Fund, which represents 20 villages in western Alaska, has asked the state's congressional delegation to make changes in how the fisheries quotas are allocated, but critics call the plan reckless and say it could endanger the entire CDQ program. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
The Coastal Villages Region Fund is the largest of the six community development quota groups. CDQs were set up under the Magnuson-Stevens Act in the early 1990s to increase economic opportunities in western Alaska. Of the six, CVRF represents the greatest number of Alaska Natives, 9,300 people spread out over the lower Kuskokwim area. Yet CVRF has the smallest fisheries quota share of all the CDQ groups, according to Communications Director Dawson Hoover. Hoover points to a colorful bar graph showing the amounts of Bering Sea fish allotted to each CDQ group's individual residents compared with CVRF's share. A red bar representing Pacific cod shoots skyward for some CDQ groups, while it is practically a flat line for CVRF.
We need our fair share of CDQ fish, not just for right now, but for our future generations.
In an April letter to Alaska's congressional delegation, CVRF's board has asked for an amendment to the Magnuson-Stevens Act to allocate an equal share of CDQ fish to each CDQ resident within 50 miles of the Bering Sea coast. The current CDQ allocations were set up under a 2006 Federal Coast Guard and Maritime Act. Hoover says the quotas were not based on population, which is a sore point with CVRF because its member village population is growing, in contrast to shrinking populations in other CDQ groups. He says quota shares should be more like permanent fund dividends, the same amount for each person. Nome's Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation represents about 9,000 residents as well. Communications Director Tyler Rhodes says the corporation doesn't want to get involved in an allocation battle.
But I would add, that's not to say we feel that the allocations are perfect. But since they were set in 2006, NSCDC has been able to realize really a great deal of success. And we believe we can continue to work and thrive under this current scenario.
But Larry Cotter, CEO of the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Community Development Association, or APICTA, says CVRF's bid to reopen old allocation fights at this time is, quote, inexplicable and reckless.
The world world is good for the CDQ groups right now, and reallocation is going to cause very significant problems for at least three of the CDQ groups. Two of them probably will not survive, and a third group, Yukon Delta, will suffer severely.
Cotter says the argument that quota share should be based on population is overly simplistic, and there's no support for it in statute or in program history.
They think that someday this is going to happen, and I think they're oblivious to the fact that it's a bad idea, it's mean, it's greedy, and it is not supported by our delegation. Coastal Villages has the largest amount of pollock among the six groups, and that's the most valuable of the CDQ species. And they have used that allocation very successfully to become the wealthiest of the six groups.
Conversely, Dawson Hoover states that CVRF is in it for the long haul.
Our 9,000 residents are learning how imbalanced the allocations are. And it's the people that are going to speak the loudest, and it's the people that are going to take up the issue. And they are taking up the issue. They are sending letters to our delegation. What's beautiful about that is they all want to be treated equally, and that's really all we're asking for.
He says the overall CDQ imbalance is not in keeping with the tradition of sharing among Alaska Natives, and as the idea spreads up and down the coast, the people of Western Alaska will support the proposal. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
For nearly a decade, the Fairbanks North Star Borough and Chena Hot Springs Resort have been working on a land sale. Last fall, the Assembly passed an ordinance to approve the sale, but as KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the deal is at an impasse because the two sides can't agree on the value of the property.
Chena Hot Springs Resort owner Bernie Carl is known for his ideas.
Some people are doers. I'm a doer.
For years, he's envisioned expanding his resort to add a wildlife viewing area and a ski hill. Carl's been working with the Fairbanks North Star Borough to buy land adjacent to his own.
I've been trying to purchase this piece of land for 10 years. I think that I've gone beyond the call of duty. I've always, I haven't ever changed my stance on my agreement to purchase the land.
Carl already has a 5-year temporary use permit from the borough for winter activities on the land. Last August, he signed a deal to pay fair market value for it. He also agreed to a series of easements across resort property. He says that includes building a bridge and a road with a $250,000 price tag. He also agreed to pay $15,000 in earnest money, but the deal has hit a roadblock.
It's sort of like hitting yourself on the head with a hammer. It feels so good when you stop.
Paul Costello is the director of the borough's Department of Land Management. He says both sides disagree on what fair market value means.
We have done everything by the book. We were working with the resort quite diligently, and I think they were too, but they just never disclosed that their definition of fair market value is a very personal definition.
As part of the purchase agreement, the borough hired an independent appraiser last fall. A 2-day visit included a tour by four-wheeler and an aerial inspection of the land. It was valued at $390 per acre. Carl says that's much too high.
I refuse to pay an inflated price. I want to pay fair market value.
Carl argues that the appraisal didn't fairly compare the property to other surrounding land, so the borough had the original appraisal reviewed. Paul Costello says the review concludes the valuation is appropriate.
That's a good deal. It's a good appraisal. It's got a lot of potential. And, you know, I don't understand, other than the fact that they don't want to pay the price.
Paul Costello offers three possible solutions to move forward. The Assembly can repeal the approving ordinance. They can authorize continued negotiations with Carl, or they can authorize the sale of the property at public auction with a starting bid at $390 per acre.
The resort could bid on it if they choose to. I would expect that they would.
Bernie Carl says he's considering the option. If the land is sold at auction, all easement agreements will be lost. The borough can still seek Carl's $15,000 in earnest money. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskananookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Biologists at Denali National Park released numbers today from their spring season wolf survey this year. In March, they observed 49 wolves in and around Denali National Park and Preserve. That number is down slightly from last year when 57 wolves were counted in the region. This spring's is the lowest count since the park started monitoring wolves in the park in 1986. In the fall, the Park Service observed 9 wolf packs in the area. That number increased to 11 this spring. It's unknown whether the 2 packs are new or if they split off from existing packs. The Park Service was able to collar a wolf from one of those 2 packs. A flock of eagles descended on the Safeway parking lot in Unalaska last week, prompting police intervention. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports.
That is the sound of an eagle party. Not terribly impressive, but the sight of it was. Public Safety Director Jamie Sunderland says several people called in short succession on Thursday afternoon to report the melee.
One of our officers went over there and observed about 40 eagles sitting kind of on, in, and around several vehicles in the area.
Sunderland says the eagles were feasting on garbage bags of fish product in the bed of a pickup truck. Public Safety contacted the truck owner,
who confirmed they did have a bunch of fillets in the car, and they were trying to get rid of it, but there were so many eagles, they were kind of, I think, somewhat alarmed to go near the vehicle because it was just being, I guess, swarmed by eagles.
Jessica Earnshaw's car was parked next to the truck, and she says she was afraid of getting attacked if she got too close.
I put my car alarm on, so maybe that would let the eagles go away, but they still didn't.
When Officer Bill Sims arrived, Earnshaw says he put on his sirens, which scared off some of the eagles, and then he went into the fray.
He's like, okay, you two just get your keys ready, and as soon as I shoo them away, run into your cars and go. We did.
No one got hurt, and Sunderland says the truck owner wasn't cited for the incident because the fish didn't make a mess in the parking lot. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
To watch a video of the swarming eagles, go to alaskapublic.org. It's been more than 50 years since there was a year-round permanent residence on King Island, and today most King Island community members who now live in Nome, Fairbanks, or Anchorage have never been to their homeland. But one person is raising money to bring members of her community to the island in the Bering Sea. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
The island is 1 mile wide. There's no beach, just boulders. And yet, the island and the ocean around it supported around 200 people year-round for thousands of years. With the buildings of the old village deteriorating from Bering Sea storms and winds, the Ahuivimut, or King Island people today, want to visit. Meet Joan Novayuk-Kane. She's spearheading the effort to raise the money needed.
The significance of going back to King Island is that for thousands of years, my ancestors and other King Islanders, our ancestors, were able to live and survive and thrive. And one of, admittedly, what everyone has said, one of the harshest environments in the world.
Under the assimilation policy toward Native Americans, the Ahuivimut were relocated starting in 1958 to urban areas where federal BIA resources were more accessible. The school was closed. King Islanders were forced to Nome or larger communities to receive a Western education at government schools. Kane's mother was forced to leave the entire Bering Strait region and attend the Copper Valley School in Glen Allen. Having grown up in Anchorage, Kane has never been to King Island. She wants to visit the place where her grandmother was raised, the place of her language, the place that has nourished her and her community. She wants to see the rocks where women of King Island used to sing, welcoming any new visitor.
There's only one person left of a whole generation of people, my grandfather's generation, that was born on King Island, raised predominantly on King Island, knows the island well and has strong recollections of the things that made King Island inhabitable. you know, made it possible for us to inhabit for thousands of years. And we're, you know, we're really on the cusp of losing so much, but we're also on the cusp of gaining so much.
Oh, it would mean so much. It would really mean so much because that's how we grew up, and I have a very fond memories of the island. Teaching, sharing, Eskimo dancing, and playing, and that's what we did.
Vince Pikawana wishes he had been born on King Island, but he was raised there until he was 12 years old. He says the best years of his life were on the island. And then he moved to a foreign place, Nome, where he was forced to learn English and be the first of his people to learn a new way of living. It's been 15 years since Vince has visited the island, and he wants to go again. He's 64 years old and is already thinking of what he will do when he travels there this summer.
Just walk around, listen to the birds, smell the air one more time, and eat from it. You know, because there are a lot of edible plants that are grown down there, and
Vince asks his wife how to say a specific word in English.
Akpit.
Salmon berries.
Salmon, and there's salmon berries grown down there and edible greens, you know.
Vince looks forward to showing people like Joan Kane around the island. Kane, through USA Projects, a crowdsourced funding agency, is working to raise $31,000 to bring a group of 20 King Islanders back to their homeland this summer.
There's no beach. There's no place to land, land a craft or an aircraft. So either you're looking at helicoptering in or getting in on a very seaworthy boat in the Bering Sea and then being able to lighter into shore. So the costs are huge. You know, most of the houses are in ruin. They're not safe to inhabit. So there's a cost of shelter while we're there. There's a cost of food and supplies.
Kane has 17 more days until May 26 to raise another $17,400. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, and Lorelei Kinnean in Nome. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaskan educators can earn a master's degree in educational leadership, special education, and more from the University of Alaska Southeast. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. Those living with asthma know that each day their life can take several different routes. So take care of yourself with daily medication and you'll be well-rested and eager to take on the day. Miss taking your medication and you'll end up with restless sleep, days at home sick, or even in the emergency room. So treat your asthma even when you're feeling your best to keep you from your worst. Information at asthmainalaska.org or 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.